What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
Oh my God, I think my heart's going to explode. We saw the cutest thing happened.
Yes, I did make a TikTok about this, but if you're one of the people not on TikTok, which I do not blame you, then this story has to be retold. Haggis is a superhero.
He is. He saved Kat's life. This was an amazing thing to witness. We were puppy sitting Champ. You've heard us talk about Champ before. Champ is an older, large, bumbling, lovable Labrador. He's got to be at least 100 pounds. He's a big blockhead.
I would say he's between 90 and 100. Yeah.
Yeah. We had one of those pig's ear dog treats somebody had given us. And so Kat tries to take it out of his mouth and put it away, and Champ wasn't having it.
No, he did not listen. He would not give it up. And he growled at me.
And Haggis jumped to full attention, ran toward this 100-pound dog, all 11 pounds of Haggis, and started barking at him. He turned around, dropped the pig's ear, and walked away. Haggis is such a hero.
Yep. Every chance he gets, JG will mention to Haggis how proud he is that he saved Mama's life.
Yeah, it did. So it was the cutest thing ever.
It really was.
He's just this little peanut.
One-tenth the size of this big boy.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, Champ has never been a problem. He's a sweet boy. It's just pig's ears. Pig's ears will do that.
Yeah, pig's ears excite the boy. So both the boys are settled down. There are no pig's ears to distract them. I get to go first. Let me just a sip of iced tea, please.
Yeah, probably you should ask Haggis permission also.
Is it okay, Haggis? Is it all right if I monopolize your mama for a minute or two? Okay. You know, it's easy
to fall in love.
And also to equate air pollution with modern times. Especially industrial pollution, dating back to October 1948 in Pennsylvania. In October of that year, Denora, Pennsylvania was completely covered in what was described as a lethal haze.
Oh.
According to EPA.gov, over 5 days, nearly half of the town's 14,000 residents experienced respiratory or cardiovascular problems. It was difficult for them to breathe. And the death toll rose to 40 people. Disturbing photos show Denora's streets hidden under a thick blanket of gray smog. What had happened is it was kind of like a perfect storm, no pun intended. A warm air pocket had passed above the town and trapped the cooler air below. It sealed in the pollutants. The area was no stranger to pollution to begin with, because they had steel and zinc smelters that had long plagued the town with dirty air.
So that's really interesting, because when I think of pollution back in the day, the days of yore, you might say, I think of like litter and that kind of thing, you know, dead bodies just everywhere.
Right.
But I don't think of air pollution. That's interesting. Like, I think of gross rivers, you know, that you can walk across or that would light on fire.
Right. That was a problem.
Air pollution, not so much.
I believe it was Lake Erie that caught on fire because of the high contaminate levels of pollution and combustible materials within the lake. Well, major strides, of course, have been made. In 1970, Congress passed the Clear Air Act Amendment, which led to the establishment of the nation's air quality standard. So things, even though they're not perfect, they're getting better. Major strides have been made to improve the air quality, but many complex scientific questions still remain that call for innovative and novel research. And we're not talking about just regulation. Sometimes technical innovation is the answer, but we are going to go back even further in history.
Even more Yori.
We're going to go back to the late 1800s. And today we're going to talk about the Great Horse Manure Crisis of 1894. The struggle was real. Let's start in the 1860s. At this time, the quickest, most popular way to get around New York City was in a horse-drawn streetcar. The horses, they would pull the trolleys along iron tracks. Mm-hmm. That, of course, was a much smoother ride than the horse-drawn omnibuses that they were quickly replacing. I came across this great article in the New Yorker. It's called Hosed. In it, it talks about the sheer numbers that New Yorkers had to deal with. During the 1860s, New Yorkers made some 35 million horse car trips a year at the start of the decade. 10 years later, by 1870, that figure had tripled.
Wow.
So they needed a lot of horse cars, and consequently they needed a lot of horses. The standard horse car would seat up to about 20 people. It was drawn by a pair of horses. The streetcars ran 16 hours a day. Each horse could only work four-hour shifts, so operating one single horse car required at least eight animals. If the route ran uphill, they would need even more horses because they would put them on shorter shifts. It was sure. a more grueling task. Or if the weather was hot, they would need still more horses. Horses, of course, were also used to transport materials and goods around the city.
Sure.
And the amount of freight arriving in New York during this time period had increased so dramatically because of railroad terminals. So the number of horses that they needed to distribute the goods to local streets grew immensely. It's said that by 1880, there were about 150,000 horses living in New York City. That's not spread out over all the boroughs and stuff, just in New York City. And there were probably a lot more. One estimate is closer to 200,000 horses.
Wow.
Just in the city in the 1880s. Each horse relieved itself on average 22 pounds of manure a day.
A day?
And?
Well, mares do eat oats.
And does eat oats.
Yeah.
Little lambs eat ivy.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about the oats with them.
No. So they're pooping out 22 pounds of manure a day and a bucket load of urine. Jeez. So this means that the city production of horse manure was at least 50 tons a month. And in addition to the mountains of horse waste, you could add in rotting horse carcasses as well, too.
That's because, a real bummer.
Yeah, because the horses, they were worked really hard. And their life expectancy was about 3 years. These were large animals, of course, and when they died, they were often just left in place. They didn't have the machinery or equipment to remove carcasses that size. So often they would just wait until it had decomposed to the point where they could remove it in pieces.
Oh my God.
In fact, there are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses and mountains of poo. It was just the way it was.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
When I was a kid, we didn't have the internet. We had dead horses and piles of horse manure to play on.
This is awful.
A guy named George Waring Jr. served as New York's cleaning commissioner, and he described Manhattan as, quote, stinking with the emanations of putrefying organic matter.
I remember banana peels were a big problem, too.
That was another episode I did. Yes. Yeah, that was a little bit later.
I don't even, if we go on vacation, I won't even go in a horse-drawn carriage. I think it's romantic. I think it's beautiful. But I can't get over the idea, like, what's that horse's life like? What are you doing?
Yeah. We were at Disney, and they had the hansom cab that you could hire.
Yeah.
Kat hired the hansom cab just to give the horse a break.
Well, I think that it's important.
Like $400 for a 10-minute rest for the horse.
Rest?
A journalist of the time wrote that the streets of Manhattan were quite literally carpeted with a, quote, warm brown matting.
Ew!
Smelling to heaven. Now, in the early part of the 1800s, it wasn't a problem, mostly because there were still farmers surrounding the city relatively close by that were happy
to take the horse manure.
Yes,
they
actually would pay the city. They would buy the horse manure and of course, use it for fertilizer. But by the time we reached the 1880s and 1890s, the market was so glutted with stable owners that they had to pay people to remove the horse manure. And it just accumulated over time, mostly in vacant lots. They would just pile it up in vacant lots.
It's kind of like our late winter snow.
Snow removal. Yes. I was thinking the exact same thing. If you go to a large parking lot in Maine, or, you know, those of you who live in northern climates, the snowbanks will be as high as the telephone poles in many cases, but it would be snow, not horse poop.
Right. But still, I hate snow.
Just be glad you're not shoveling horse poop. Now, of course, these vacant lots, brimming with horse crap, were an ideal breeding ground for flies. Mm. By the 1890s, the manure crisis seemed virtually impossible to overcome. And New York wasn't the only place having the issue. It was worldwide, major cities especially. London was struggling. In 1894, the Times of London wrote an article about the crisis, and their prediction was that by the 1950s, every street in the city of London and in New York would be buried under 9 feet of manure. And this was not an exaggeration. This was based on math. They figured out how many horses, how many pounds. We don't have that much room for it. It's just going to pile up. Now, by this time, they did have an understanding that disease could be transmitted by flies, and they recognized that a public health crisis was inevitable.
Right.
So in 1898, they assembled the very first International Urban Planning Conference, and discussion was dominated by the manure crisis.
It was a poop committee. Got it.
But they just couldn't come up with any viable solutions. They couldn't imagine cities working without horses. You needed horses to drive industry. So the delegates broke up their meeting, even though it had been scheduled for a week and a half, 3 days, and they said, "Now we give up." The overall opinion was, quote, "Oh, well, something will come up."
No.
Yeah, that was in the official.
Well, if they had these big lots, like these places where the poop was being piled, mm-hmm. why not grow food there? Why not build gardens that you can then use the manure in? Rather than just piles of poo, it would be somewhat functional. Or build buildings for the poo in the meantime until you can, rotate the poo.
I think, yes, horse manure is great for growing crops, but I think you need some dirt. Too.
Well, I mean, yes.
And there just wasn't enough to go around because it was all covered in mountains of horse poop. Miraculously, the crisis passed. This was not brought about by regulation or any government policies. It was because of technological innovation. Electricity became more widely available. And of course, the development of the internal combustion engine. Mm. These innovations led to the development of different ways to move people and goods, not having to use horses. According to Tradesmith Daily, in October of 1908, Henry Ford introduced the Model T. It quickly became America's car. Ford didn't invent the auto. He didn't invent the assembly line, but he was the first to put those two concepts together, and he created the very first mass-manufactured automobile. Because he could control the pricing, he could sell it at a price point that most Americans were able to afford. This slowly put city horses out of business. As they disappeared from the streets, their manure and carcasses did as well. In New York City, cars outnumbered horses. By 1912, this happened quickly.
Wow.
And in 1917, the city's very last horse-drawn streetcar made its final run. Very quickly, the streets began to clear, and the piles of manure slowly disappeared. So what did the great horse manure crisis of 1894 teach us? Experts say to expect the unexpected, particularly regarding technology. Nobody saw that coming.
Right.
They thought, we're fucked. And then along comes out of nowhere, out of left field, electricity in automobiles, just completely in a very short amount of time, completely changing the face of how one would live and do business in major cities. History does dictate that technology will advance in a way unexpectedly, solving issues that we may be experiencing right now. For example, fossil fuels. This is probably something big oil companies don't want to hear. But then again, if you were the heir to a buggy whip fortune in 1908, Henry Ford was probably the most evil person in the world.
Right. Where are all the anvils?
So let's be optimistic. There's incredible technology that come our way at some point and change the paradigm in ways that we don't even understand yet.
I was watching something the other day about a high school kid made this contraption that floats on the water surface and like eats garbage. And it just goes around. It's kind of like self-propelling and nom, 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 the garbage. The idea is that we can start to clean up the Great Pacific garbage patch.
Sure.
Which really shocking that we haven't done an episode on the friggin' garbage patch. But anyway, this amazing contraption is just eating up the garbage.
Now, when you say eat, you mean collecting it, or is it somehow dissolving it?
A little bit of both.
Digesting it? Is it biological?
It's not biological. I don't remember how, but it's somehow taking care of it, because it's not just collecting the garbage to take it elsewhere. It's like disposing of it.
Wow.
And I don't know how. Don't ask me. I say I read an article, but I skimmed the article, let's be honest.
Okay. Well, you got past the headline, so that's more than a lot of people. So that's the great horseman or crisis of 1894. My information came from The New Yorker, EPA.org, Tradesmith Daily.
That is amazing.
And now, that thing in the middle.
Nikolai Paganini was a violinist, but not just any violinist. He was probably the greatest violinist ever. In fact, he was so good, many people believed he was the son of the devil. He, of course, denied that, but people wouldn't believe him. So, he had to publicly reveal letters written to him by his mother to prove that he actually had a human parent.
Warning: repeated use of this podcast may cause enlightenment, queasiness, and/or fits of laughter. Discontinue use if rash develops. But send us a photo first. We're into some weird shit around here. This is The Box of Oddities. The Box of Oddities with Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth.
Hey, Nikki sent us this private message. Hey, you lovely people. Greetings from New Zealand. Started listening to your show recently and I am in love. I work in a nursery growing trees, so I listen to a lot of podcasts. You guys have me laughing out loud numerous times a day, getting curious looks from my coworkers. Wanted to share a story that related to that thing in the middle from one of your early shows. The weird, creepy shit kids say.
Yeah.
So when my little boy was about 5, we got a new kitten, and he was besotted. I love that word. He was playing with her on the floor, and he says, "Oh my God, she's so cute. I want to cut her face off and stick it on mine." Wow.
I get it.
So, yep, just wanted to share. Our cat stayed intact and has now had kittens of her own, so all is well. Anyhoozle, thank you, beautiful people. So happy I got you in my ears all day. Nikki, that's cute aggressiveness, isn't
it? Yeah. I mean, I get that. That makes perfect sense. It's like, it's a documented phenomena. Phenomena. Some people like have too much overload, like cuteness overload, and they don't know what to do with that excess feeling, and it comes out as aggression. And it's weird.
Well,
but I get it.
I can't tell you how many times Kat will be holding one of the dogs and just squeezing the dog, not to the point where the dog's in any danger, but then she'll look at me and say, "I want to bite through his ear with my eye teeth."
Yeah.
And then you describe to me in great detail what that would be like.
Mm-hmm.
You could feel the tooth
pierce the skin and kind of pop through
it. Pop right through.
Yeah, I want to bite their skin. I want to But it, I don't know. I don't know why. I mean, the same thing with you. There are some times where I look at you and you're sleeping and you're so peaceful and I just want to smash your face.
We have a complex relationship.
I just love you so much.
Well, my love, what you got for me?
What you got for me?
What you got for me?
There we go. Okay.
Oh, you turned me down.
Yeah. Rheumatoid arthritis. That sounded a little aggressive. Sorry. Rheumatoid arthritis, also known as RA, is an autoimmune disorder that causes chronic inflammation of joints. It's very uncomfortable. It tends to begin slowly with minor symptoms that kind of come and go, and it progresses over a period of time. Symptoms of this chronic condition do vary from person to person, and they can change from day to day. However, flare-ups, which is when you're having symptoms, can be very uncomfortable. Movement is uncomfortable. Clenching is uncomfortable. Bending, all the things that people do, like on the daily, it's uncomfortable. And you can see why that wouldn't be pleasant or something that someone wanted to live with. Obviously, we want a cure.
Or at least some whiskey.
An Ayurvedic medical text from the year 123, which is very pleasing to me, refers to a disease characterized by swollen, painful joints, occasional fever, and in all likelihood, this was a description of RA.
You don't even have your harness on. How are you finding ways to make your harness make noise?
The physician of Roman Emperor Claudius made observations that might lead us to believe that he suffered from RA. In 1852, Sir Alfred Garrod renamed the condition rheumatoid arthritis and defined it as a separate condition from osteoarthritis. Mm-hmm. So that's when it kind of started to become a little bit better understood. Okay, this is this, that's that, and that's how. Okay. So in the olden days, once again,
The days of yore.
Treatments for rheumatoid arthritis included bloodletting and leeching. Plant-based treatments like willow bark were used. In the Far East, they developed practices of acupuncture and acupressure, and cupping were used, the use of heat especially.
I never really understood the idea of bleeding people to make them better.
I don't really either. I mean, I understand that they thought that bad blood was a thing.
Some bad blood in there. But obviously not all of it's bad. How do you know which blood is the bad blood when you're just cutting somebody open and letting them bleed out?
I don't know.
My son isn't feeling very well. Let's take him to the barber and bleed him out. That'll help.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the thought process back in the days of yore.
Right. Well, we very often end up in the same time period with our stories. And that's, again, what's happened today. We're talking about the late 1800s. And you know how during that time period, people were always looking for a new cure. It became a big problem because all kinds of things were being sold and prescribed, quote unquote, as being the next cure when really they didn't have any curative properties at all.
But lots of opium.
Lots of opium. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Pretty much all medicine had opium in it.
Well, I want to tell you about one of the cures that was available in the late 1800s.
Oh, I love this.
To cure RA. Sitting inside a rotting whale carcass. Now, according to an 1896 story published in the New York Times, the whale cure was popularized after a gentleman of questionable habits, but grievously afflicted with rheumatism, noticed a whale carcass on the beach. A jokester, he decided to jump right in. Some people later said that he was drunk. His friends were horrified, but, quote, the heat and the smell were too great for them to rescue their ally. So they waited around for him to come out.
How long did that take?
Yeah, I mean, it was a while.
Really?
It was a few hours.
No.
One source claims that the first man to try the whale cure stumbled upon it accidentally after falling into the carcass drunk. He supposedly became stuck and emerged free of his rheumatoidism and very sober a few hours later. Another attributes the first case to a well-known businessman who approached a prominent local whaling family, and he wanted to just try it out. He'd heard that heat worked, and he thought, where can I find heat? Inside a rotting whale.
Sure. I would have said fire, but whatever.
Huh. Weird. So he convinced the whaling guy to allow him to try this out when next they brought a whale to shore. So after spending a day inside the oily, bloody cavern of the whale, the man emerged allegedly cured.
This has to be like a placebo kind of thing.
So when a whale is killed and towed ashore and the carcass retains a little warmth, this is how it works. A hole is cut through one side of the whale's body, sufficiently large to admit the patient. The lower part of whose body, from the feet to the loins, should sink into the whale's intestines.
Oh, no.
Leaving the head, of course, outside the aperture. The latter is closed up as tightly as possible. Otherwise, the patient would not be able to breathe through the volumes of anatomical gases which would escape from every opening left uncovered.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, decomp creates gases and...
Yeah.
That came from the whale cure for rheumatism in Australia, published by The Graphic, May of 1902. Now, this comes from the Smithsonian Magazine. The man, after having been submerged in the whale carcass, the rheumatism from which he had been suffering for years had entirely disappeared. And after that, the town of Eden, Australia, became a sort of dead whale equivalent to Turkish baths.
So it was like surgical tourism for the day.
Sure,
Let's go there, and they've got all the best dead whales.
So preferably, in order for the cure to work most effectively, the patient was expected to remain within the whale carcass at intervals for 20 to 30 hours.
Oh, my God. But they got to get out for a little bit.
Well, I think they weren't expected to, like, relieve themselves inside the whale. So.
Yeah, that'd be gross.
Right? Ew. Yeah.
Now, do they get in naked, I wonder? Because if you're wearing clothes, you're throwing those away.
Yeah, I don't think they got naked. All the illustrations that I saw, yes, I will be sharing, show people dressed in normal garb.
Okay. All right.
Including ladies in, like, dresses with lace and shit. It's very strange. Okay. So, a story of the incident was published by the Pall Mall Gazette, entitled A New Cure for Rheumatism, on March 7, 1896. It said, a gentleman had been walking along the beach with friends when he spotted a whale, which was already cut open, and appeared to our hilarious friend a tempting morsel of flesh. So, version of the story is that this guy was just interested in having a little nibble on the rotting carcass and somehow slipped within.
Oops.
His friends, horrified by the heat and smell, left him inside for several hours until he emerged devoid of rheumatism and sober. The curator of the Australian National Maritime Museum exhibit, Michelle Linder, told the Sydney Morning Herald that it was unlikely to have been, quote, a really popular thing to do. I don't know, she said, if there was scientific evidence per se to support the practice, but there was hearsay at the time that people were feeling better after being inside the whale. Now, yes, the whale decomposing would have created heat, and they say that rheumatoid arthritis is relieved by heat. So there may have, in fact, been some short-term relief, but not something that you couldn't get from a hot towel.
This is amazing. My thought is it's one of two things. One, it's like a placebo effect. Or two, the guy that fell in initially was so embarrassed by the turn of events that he claimed he did it so it cured his rheumatoid arthritis. And so then other people would try it and it didn't work. and they just lied about it because they didn't want to, you know, they thought
they were covered in whale carcass.
Well, yeah, they were covered in whale carcass, and they were afraid they were being punked.
So it was believed that the heat and gases produced by the decomposing whale, as we said, would create a sweat box style environment, which would relieve rheumatic disorders. Again, though, this is a thing that you can accomplish in other ways.
With a hot towel.
With a hot towel. It's said that one of these treatments could relieve your RA for up to 12 months.
Interesting.
Mm. So, of course, bay whaling meant that whalers would hunt the migrating whales on small boats. And then rather than handling the carcass while they were out to sea, they would drag them to shore, which is why there was such a plethora of carcass to hang out in.
Mm.
And lots of opportunities for visitors to Eden to try the famous whale cure. The first reference that I found of it was in 1896. And the last reference that I found of it was 1902. So I don't know that it only happened between those years, but it seems like the period in which people were taking part in this activity was a small one.
It was a short-lived fad, like fidget spinners.
Yep.
But it smelled a lot worse.
Right.
I love old folk medical remedies.
Mm, yeah.
Stuff like that intrigues me.
Well, I get it. I get the idea that maybe you came across something and I found this thing and it was right in front of us this whole time. And I get that, you know, I get being down at the stream, mixing up some mustard seed with cayenne and thinking, yes, this is it. Bye bye, AIDS. You know,
I get it. And that struck a note with a lot of people. When you told that story about how you used to do that,
yeah,
we got so many messages from people saying, oh my God, I did the same thing. This is crazy.
Mm.
My great uncle, my grandmother's brother.
Mama or?
Mama.
Okay.
Back in the 30s.
The plane guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Uncle Donald. He had a plane. But before he had the plane, they were potato farmers.
Right.
The family still is. And in the 30s, he was walking along the top of a potato house, and he fell through the floor. And he...
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. I never thought twice about the fact that it was called a potato house and how silly that is until just now.
We just take it for granted in northern Maine. Oh, it's a potato house.
It's a barn.
It's a friggin' barn. Anyway, he falls through and he fractures his leg. And he's the quintessential northern Maine rural kind of guy, you know, very self-sufficient.
Old Duff kind of.
Yep. And so he's lying there with his brother. His brother Carl was with him. And he goes, Carl, get over here and set this leg for me. And so Carl came over and they snapped his leg back into position again.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl says to Donald, you know, I better take you down to see the doctor. And he goes, I don't need a doctor. I just put a cow patty on it and be good. And so he puts cow shit on the open wound where the bone was sticking through moments prior.
Sure.
And it worked. At least until the gangrene set in. And then they had to take him to Boston and he lost his leg.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then he got his pilot's license. There were some things in between, but it doesn't really matter. Anyway, what we're learning here today, among other things, is that don't put cow shit on an open wound.
It seems like there's a real theme throughout today's episode that involves feces and rotting carcass.
Well, there's a good chance that that's going to be the case in any of our episodes.
That's a valid point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
You're fascinating.
You are.
I love your face.
You're gross.
Blech.
You're so gross.
Blech.
I hate you.
Blech. I can smash your face. Really want to thank those of you who have joined us on Patreon. Seen a real influx. Don't know what's going on, but I like it. I'm thrilled, and I'm really excited that we have, in earnest, started plans for an upcoming not quite live show from our basement or another room in our home, possibly an empty room in a nearby building. We haven't decided yet, but we are making a plan.
Yes. In fact, we have a conference call in about 20 minutes on how to logistically do this.
Yes.
So look forward to that. We'll give you details as soon as we have them. And what was it you wanted to say before we wrapped today?
Oh, yeah. So the last time we were talking about my freak out about the chocolate chip cookie thing.
Yeah.
And someone pointed out that the recipe may have called for an entire bag of chocolate chips.
And that never occurred
to me.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever made anything that called for an entire bag of chocolate chips. I don't make double batches of things. And maybe that's the case. And if that's the case, fine. Dump away. Dump away. I retract my statement. Unless, of course, it wasn't for a whole bag of chips, in which case it was still reckless.
We're lying in bed at night the other night. And I'm reading, she's reading, and she just looks over and says, can you believe that? A whole bag. And this is like 2 days after her chocolate chip cookie recipe rant. Anyway, if you don't know what we're talking about, listen to the previous episode and you'll have all the details. And
it's not worth it.
It's
don't
really
to
don't
it.
Worth it. No, it's really not worth
it's
it. No.
Terrible.
Yeah. It's, frankly, I'm surprised you're listening to this episode, but we do appreciate it. Also, thanks to Medium and Authority Magazine. They did a really nice article on us. That was great.
Right?
They called us podcast stars.
I don't understand that.
What, were they drunk when they wrote that? And if that's the case, we need to buy liquor and send it to more journalists. We love you guys. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
Fly it proudly, you beautiful, beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. Henceforth, the Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories. Stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. On Facebook at facebook.com/Box of Oddities Podcast. On Twitter at Box of Oddities. And Instagram at Box of Oddities Podcast. Copyright 2021. All rights reserved.